Chapter 4. Who was Jeffrey Epstein? Journalist Edward J. Epstein described the first time he saw beneath the veneer of Jeffrey Epstein. The two had met at a Halloween party in New York in 1987. Finding out that Edward Epstein, no relation, was flying to Spain the following week, Epstein offered to upgrade his ticket to first class. As instructed, Edward dropped his luggage off at Epstein's one-bedroom apartment on East 66th Street, and his flight was duly upgraded. Epstein aided Edward with similar upgrades until a year later, when, trying to board an all-Nippon Airways flight, Edward was told his ticket was not valid, and he was moved unceremoniously to economy. Edward later found out from a friend of Epstein's that the high-flying financier had obtained a bunch of first-class stickers from a friend, which he merely stuck onto the luggage to fool the check-in attendants. The scam apparently only worked one in three times, and Edward had finally got unlucky. It's a typical Epstein story, and one that sums up the contradictions in his character. Described by some as generous to a fault, to others, he was a cheapskate and a fraud. Charming, sweet, funny and kind to some. To others, he was dark, calculating and ruthless. A true trickster with no emotions or empathy. Many who met him were bowled over by the brilliance of his mind, while others saw only a fake. Surrounded by every kind of opulence, he was nearly always seen in clothes so casual that they bordered on scruffy. Touted by many as a financial genius, others questioned where all his clients were. Whatever the true character behind his ever-changing facade, there was no arguing about Epstein's wealth and influence. Private jets and helicopters, including a converted commercial Boeing 727. Properties that included the largest private residence in Manhattan, a 10,000-acre ranch in New Mexico, and his own private island in the Caribbean, and friends like Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew. Somewhere along the line, this supposed Wall Street whiz kid had garnered some serious power. But when? And how? There was certainly nothing in his background or childhood that hinted at the person Epstein would become. Born on January the 20th, 1953, in Seagate, a gated community on Brooklyn's Coney Island, Jeffrey Epstein was the first son of distinctly lower-middle-class parents. His mother, Pauline, was a school assistant, and his father, Seymour, a gardener for the New York City Department of Parks and Recreation. Both parents were the children of Jewish immigrants from Europe, who, according to the book Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, had lost several family members in the Holocaust. Epstein's brother Mark was born a year later, and within 4 years, the two were attending a local public school. Epstein began studying the piano at the age of five and showed an aptitude for learning with a specific talent for mathematics, joining the mathematics team in Lafayette High School in Brooklyn, where he graduated in 1969. He studied mathematics at Manhattan's Cooper Union College before dropping out in 1971. Then attended New York University's Courant Institute of Mathematical Sciences before dropping out again in 1974. Epstein never earned a degree. It's somewhat of a mystery why he dropped out of both colleges, but it would be the start of a trend that would follow him his whole life. All his endeavors seemed to end with him pulling out early, being fired, leaving in disgrace, or often, with the organization itself going down in flames. Was there already a hint of the monster he would become in those hasty college departures? Another pattern in Epstein's tumultuous life was that each disaster, ironically, seemed to lead to greater opportunities, as if he were being rewarded rather than punished for his failures. This trend also started early, After his premature departure from New York University, the qualificationless young man somehow landed a job as a physics and mathematics teacher at Dalton, one of Manhattan's most prestigious private schools. Journalist Edward J. Epstein was told by a private detective from the Kroll Agency, hired by a board member of Leslie Wexner's company, Limited Brands, to investigate Epstein, that he had faked his resume to get the role at Dalton. With hindsight, it's appalling to think of the paedophile monster having access to so many underage girls at Dalton. There were no formal complaints of sexual misconduct against him during his time at the school. However, some pupils reported him hanging around students socially in a manner that they thought inappropriate. According to a New York Times article, with Epstein even turning up to student parties. Whether or not he was involved in sexual abuse, Epstein didn't last long at Dalton. In 1976, just 2 years after he had started, he was fired, his performance deemed substandard. Again, the failure metamorphosed into an opportunity. A friend of Bear Stearns' bank head, Alan Greensburg, was a parent at the school. At a parent-teacher conference, Epstein turned on the charm, and the financier father was so dazzled that he recommended Epstein to Greenberg for a job. Epstein's career at Bear Stearns began later that year as a lowly junior assistant to a floor trader. However, Greenberg took Epstein under his wing, introducing him to every area of the business, and within 4 years, he had risen to become a limited partner. Epstein quickly became a millionaire and grew a network of wealthy and influential clients, including, according to Epstein Dead Men Tell No Tales, Edgar Bronfman, president of Seagram, and a friend and associate of Leslie Wexner, a man who would become intimately linked with Epstein's future exploits. But in the meantime, the familiar pattern was re-emerging. In 1981, Epstein was fined for lending money to a friend and using his insider knowledge to guide him in how to invest it. Soon afterwards, a Securities and Exchange Commission, SEC investigation into Epstein's client, Bronfman, led to Epstein leaving the bank under a cloud of suspicion. According to Epstein, he quit, but others say he was fired. The next period of his life is one of the most clouded and mysterious. During much of the 80s, he travelled widely and often lived outside the US, mostly in Europe. He flew on an Austrian passport with a fake name that listed him as living in Saudi Arabia. He had set up his own consulting firm, Intercontinental Assets Group, IAG, which operated out of a building on East 66th Street in Manhattan. Claiming he was a kind of financial bounty hunter who recovered stolen money for clients, he also, during this period, said that he worked for the CIA, which he later denied. He was clearly dealing with some unusual characters. One of his clients was Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi international arms dealer, who had been heavily involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, where US weapons sales to Iran were used to fund and import cocaine from the Contra rebels in Nicaragua. Stephen Hoffenberg, who would employ Epstein later in the 80s, said Epstein was working for Sir Douglas Lees, a shadowy British arms dealer who was in part responsible for British arms deals with Saudi Arabia. Hoffenberg claims that most of Epstein's work at the time was illegal, involving money laundering, spying, and illegal arms sales, including that of the AWACS spy plane. One of the stories about Epstein from around this time, according to an article in the Evening Standard, was that he turned up at Lees's house carrying a New York police-issue pump-action riot gun. God knows how he got it into the country, a friend commented, according to the report. It was also during this period that ex-Israeli intelligence agent Ari Ben Menashe, claims Epstein first met Robert Maxwell, the millionaire media mogul. Aside from his above-board enterprises, Maxwell was operating for Israeli intelligence, selling arms, laundering money, and spying on foreign governments. Ben Menashe says Maxwell recruited Epstein for Israeli intelligence, and this would fit in with his many covert movements and dealings at the time. It has been speculated that much of Epstein's funds came directly from Maxwell, and it may be that Maxwell was eyeing him up as a kind of successor within the intelligence world, especially as, according to Menashe, Epstein had already begun a relationship with his daughter, Ghislaine. Official accounts are that Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell didn't meet until the early 90s, when the heiress moved to New York, but Ben Menashe claims they were already romantically involved during the late 80s. Another key figure Epstein met during this time was the billionaire businessman Leslie Wexner, the founder and CEO of Limited Brands, a fashion conglomerate that included Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works. But according to independent journalist Whitney Webb, Wexner also had ties to organized crime via the Mega Group, a consortium of Jewish billionaires which he had co-founded with Edgar Bronfman, who, as we saw earlier, was already linked to Epstein and some dodgy dealings at Bear Stearns. According to Webb, Wexner and Epstein were involved in the relocation of cargo from Southern Air Transport, SAT, from Florida to Ohio, Wexner's home state, where he could use it to shift goods to and from the Far East. SAT had been a CIA front company that had transported arms, money and drugs in the Iran-Contra affair. So Wexner and Epstein's interest in the air company could point to the CIA links that Epstein boasted about. Webb also points out that many of the individuals Epstein was working with had links to the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI, otherwise known as the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International. BCCI was also reputed to have CIA and Mossad links, and to be involved in money laundering, arms dealing, and even child trafficking. During this time, there seemed to be no evidence of paedophilia or child abuse. Epstein had a string of girlfriends and affairs, but they were all with adult women. He referred to one illicit affair with a secretary at Bear Stearns in his testimony to the SEC. Longer-term relationships came with Paula Heil Fisher, another Bear Stearns colleague, and Eva Anderson, later Anderson Dubin, a doctor and one-time Miss Sweden. Neither has ever mentioned anything wayward about Epstein's sexuality, but there is a hint of something untoward that came from the relationship with Anderson Dubin. According to several reports in 2019, Epstein was said to have had a very close relationship with Eva Anderson Dubin's daughter, Selena. And although there have been no allegations of sexual improprieties, he was reported to have declared his desire to marry the teenager. It is interesting to note that Eva Anderson Dubin's husband, hedge fund billionaire Glenn Dubin, is one of the men Epstein victim Virginia Giuffre claims she was forced to have sex with. Whatever activities Epstein was involved in throughout the 80s, his rise to prominence continued. In 1987, he was hired by Stephen Hoffenberg, founder and CEO of Towers Financial, a corporate debt collection agency. Hoffenberg says Epstein was recommended to him by British arms dealer Douglas Lees. Hoffenberg agreed to meet him and was immediately impressed by Epstein's ability to understand complex financial concepts, his charm, his knack for salesmanship, and his roguery. Hoffenberg went so far as to call Epstein a mastermind in criminality and a master manipulator. According to an interview with the authors of Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales. He also said that despite Epstein's many unusual dealings throughout the 80s, the international player was stone broke, intimating that, once again, Epstein had gotten into undisclosed trouble in Europe. One story tells how at the time Epstein was living rent-free in one of the East 66th Street apartments while holding parties on the roof, so that guests would assume that he owned the penthouse suite. Despite, or perhaps because of, Epstein's criminal talents, Hoffenberg decided to hire him, paying him $25,000 a month and setting him up in offices in the historic Villard House on Manhattan's Madison Avenue. At first, Epstein and Hoffenberg attempted to use Tower Financial as a corporate raiding vessel, but they were completely unsuccessful. Failing in attempts to take over Pan American Airways in 1987 and Emery Air Freight Corporation in 1988. They then switched efforts to less savoury enterprises, raising money from investors to pay off other investors in a corporate scam that has been labelled one of the biggest Ponzi schemes in American history, losing investors over $450 million. Epstein left Towers Financial in 1989, but in 1993, the firm was investigated for corruption. Hoffenberg was found guilty and sentenced to 20 years in jail with a $1 million fine and $463 million in restitution. Epstein, however, who was deeply bound up in the fraud, according to Hoffenberg, walked away scot-free. According to Hoffenberg, the trustee in charge of the case, Alan Cohen, hired lawyers Indyk and Kahn to investigate Epstein's role in the affair. This is remarkable, because both Indyk and Kahn were long-term friends of Epstein. Indeed, the lawyer and accountant became joint executors of Epstein's estate after his death. So perhaps it is no wonder that he escaped without charges. Even better for Epstein, Hoffenberg claimed in an interview with the authors of Epstein, Dead Men Tell No Tales, Epstein was able to keep the money he had illegally earned from the Ponzi scheme and used it to set up his companies, J. Epstein & Company, and International Assets Group. Leaving the ashes of another disaster scene smouldering behind, Epstein moved blithely on. It was now that his connection with Leslie Wexner deepened. Wexner became a client, in fact, the only known client, of J. Epstein & Company, a financial management firm that boasted of only taking on billion-dollar customers. Epstein reportedly tidied up Wexner's fortunes, saving him a lot of money. But the relationship went much deeper. In 1991, Wexner granted Epstein full power of attorney over his affairs. If this wasn't enough, the billionaire purchased the Herbert N. Strauss Mansion on 71st Street in Manhattan for $13.2 million, completely refurbishing it with closed-circuit TV cameras in every room and a special room for monitoring them. Wexner then gifted this property to Epstein for free, or, as Maria Farmer reported Epstein saying, for just $1. The fact that Wexner would spend so much time and money setting up a mansion that was rigged for total monitoring adds credence to the claims that Wexner and Epstein were working together on a honey trap scheme to blackmail prominent US and international figures for intelligence, most likely on behalf of Israel. But other testimony points to an even closer clandestine relationship. Maria Farmer claims that the two were allegedly involved in an illicit love affair. She says she was told this by Epstein's longtime personal chef, who had previously worked as a private chef for Wexner. Whatever the truth about the relationship, Wexner certainly had total trust in Epstein, not only granting him power of attorney, but also making him a director of the Wexner Foundation. Once the New York mansion had been refurbished, Epstein moved in. The sheer size and opulence of the property give some indication of the kind of lifestyle the ex-high school teacher was now living in, as well as his quirky sense of humour. The 9-floor, 40-room ex-school building is reportedly Manhattan's largest private residence. It was described by journalist Vicky Ward, who was invited inside as part of her profile on Epstein for Vanity Fair, as a private Xanadu. The entrance hall, according to Ward, was filled with individually framed eyeballs that were imported from Britain, where they had been made for wounded soldiers. Perhaps there was a mischievous hint here at the monitoring operation going on throughout the property, a brazen yet tongue-in-cheek warning that guests were being watched. Moving on into the marble foyer, guests were overwhelmed by a twice-larger-than-life statue of a naked African warrior. Ward was served tea in the so-called leather room, with leopard-print chairs and a huge painting of a woman holding an opium pipe and caressing a snarling lion skin. Ward was then taken upstairs to Epstein's office, which she described as an enormous gallery spanning the width of the house. Strangely, the office had no computer, but did contain a huge gilded desk that once belonged to J.P. Morgan, a 9-foot Steinway grand piano, and a Persian rug, so huge that according to Epstein, it must have come from a mosque. Amidst all the exotic grandeur, however, was an incongruous detail. A stuffed black poodle standing on the grand piano. It was another example of Epstein's perverse sense of humour, summed up by his characteristic standoffish smirk that suggested he was secretly laughing at everyone around him. One feature Ward didn't mention was a secret bathroom, described by a New York Times article as reminiscent of James Bond movies, hidden beneath a stairway, lined with lead to provide shelter from attack, and supplied with closed-circuit television screens and a telephone, both concealed in a cabinet beneath the sink. It was around this time that Epstein officially met Ghislaine Maxwell, the British socialite and daughter of media mogul Robert Maxwell, who had died in suspicious circumstances aboard his superyacht, the Lady Ghislaine. Ghislaine Maxwell had recently moved to New York following her father's death in 1991. Epstein and Maxwell supposedly met at a New York party following her breakup with Count Gianfranco Giacogna Mazzoni of the CIGA Hotels dynasty. However, as already mentioned, there is evidence that Epstein had already met and may even have been having an affair with Maxwell since the mid to late 80s. Indeed, the same sources claim that it was Maxwell's Mossad-connected father who introduced Epstein to the world of espionage and set him up in a role with Israeli intelligence. This leads to speculation that Epstein could have been the benefactor of some of the missing millions that Robert Maxwell stole from his Mirror Group pension funds, which would certainly explain Epstein's meteoric rise to wealth. Whatever the case, Epstein and Maxwell were soon inseparable, and holding lavish parties at the camera-riddled Manhattan mansion provided by Wexner. Parties attended by large numbers of young-looking foreign models who were ostensibly recruited for Wexner's Victoria's Secret brand. It seems highly likely that Epstein and Maxwell's careers as sexual blackmailers of the rich, famous, and influential had begun in earnest. One guest at Epstein's townhouse described it as being filled with foreign women who were dressed rather bizarrely. And the same woman mentioned a cocktail party attended by Epstein's friend, Prince Andrew, where there were young Russian models everywhere. Some of the guests were horrified, reported the scandalized woman. If Epstein wanted to attract the rich and famous for his blackmail operation, he was certainly beginning to succeed. Around this time, he acquired his private jet, a refurbished Boeing 727, later referred to as the Lolita Express. He had the former commercial airliner fitted with padded floors, a circular lounge area, a dining area with attached galley kitchen, and even a private bedroom with double bed and ensuite shower. It's alleged by his victims that the jet was used for secret sex parties. Flight logs show dozens of celebrity guests, including Prince Andrew, Kevin Spacey, Naomi Campbell, Chris Tucker, David Blaine, Bill Gates, Ehud Barak, and Tony Blair. One of the biggest and most frequent names on the Lolita flight logs was Bill Clinton. The former US president flew on the jet no less than 27 times, despite claiming he'd only done 4 trips. Indeed, Epstein and Clinton may have had a relationship that was far closer and longer than the official records suggest. Epstein survivor Maria Farmer claims that Clinton was a frequent visitor to the Manhattan mansion in the early 90s, when he was still president. Yet his visits were without a security detail, and everyone was ordered to clear the house, except for the chef and 2 Filipino maids. Epstein made substantial donations to the Clinton Foundation, and even helped set up the Clinton Global Initiative. He also visited the White House during Clinton's administration on 4 recorded occasions. Could it be that Clinton was one of the highest profile, perhaps the highest profile, victim of Epstein's honeypot blackmail scheme? As a later chapter will show, there is certainly evidence to believe so. Another presidential name on the flight logs was Donald J. Trump. Another high-profile friendship of Epstein's that had murky beginnings sometime in the 80s. Trump and Epstein may have first met at a boat party thrown aboard the Lady Guilin by Robert Maxwell. But like so many of Epstein's acquaintanceships, there are different stories depending on who you speak to. What is certain is that the two were neighbours in Palm Beach, Florida, from 1990, when Epstein bought a property on El Brillo Way, for $2.5 million. Trump owned the nearby Mar-a-Lago resort, and the two tycoons were often seen partying together. Described by friends and acquaintances as tight, each other's wingmen, and, together with Trump's friend Tom Barak, a set of nightlife musketeers, Trump and Epstein were even captured on video at one Mar-a-Lago party where Trump is pointing out to Epstein a woman he finds attractive. In 2002, Trump was quoted in New York Magazine as saying of Epstein, "He's a terrific guy. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side." Later the two fell out in 2004 over a bidding war for a Palm Beach property which Trump won. In 2008, Trump reportedly threw Epstein out of Mar-a-Lago following his first sex abuse trial. And in 2019, Trump told the press he wasn't a fan of Epstein. However, whatever had come between them, Trump clearly had associated with Epstein. There is even testimony from Maria Farmer that Trump's ex-wife, Ivana, had accompanied Ghislaine Maxwell on expeditions around New York when Maxwell was hunting for young girls for Epstein. Another high-rolling friend of Epstein's was Prince Andrew, the Duke of York, and second son of the Queen of England. Andrew and Epstein were apparently introduced by Ghislaine Maxwell, who had been friends with the prince since her Oxford University days. The trio began hanging around together in the late 90s and soon appeared inseparable, turning up to parties all over the globe, including a combined royal birthday party at Windsor Castle, attended by the Queen, followed by a weekend at Sandringham the Queen's country estate, for Guillain's 39th birthday. The same year, 2000, Epstein and Andrew were seen together on no fewer than 5 occasions, including on a luxury yacht in Thailand, where they were photographed surrounded by topless women. But holidaying with Epstein wasn't the only thing Andrew got up to. According to Epstein survivor Virginia Giuffre, in court documents, she was paid to have sex with Andrew on 3 occasions when she was just 17, one of which was an orgy that included underage Russian girls. Andrew continued to be friends with Epstein after his 2008 conviction for sexual abuse, and even attended Epstein's release from prison party in 2010 at his New York mansion, where the prince stayed for 4 days. Andrew was photographed standing in the doorway of the building, waving surreptitiously goodbye to a young-looking girl. The prince later said he had flown to New York to say goodbye to Epstein and terminate their friendship in person, because he could no longer associate with the convicted felon. It was Epstein's 2008 Florida conviction that first exposed the sordid underbelly of his glamorous lifestyle. In 2005, Palm Beach police were notified of a teenage girl who had been given $300 to strip naked and massage the 52-year-old Epstein. Detective Joseph Recare began an undercover investigation of the businessman, which interviewed 34 victims, all of whom had similar testimonies. Either they were asked to strip naked and massage Epstein while he pleasured himself, or they were sexually abused or raped by him. All the girls were underage, some as young as 14, many having been recruited from a local public high school. In October 2005, Recare and his team raided Epstein's Palm Beach home, finding several computers had been removed with the leads left dangling. It seemed somehow that Epstein had been tipped off. Even so, the police had enough evidence to accuse the financier. The FBI soon joined in, launching their own investigation into Epstein, which led to his indictment in June 2007. However, Epstein's star-studded team of lawyers, which included Alan Dershowitz of O.J. Simpson trial fame, somehow cut a plea deal with the state attorney, Alex Acosta, that granted Epstein immunity from all federal criminal charges, along with 4 named co-conspirators and any unnamed potential co-conspirators. Epstein now faced just state charges of procuring for prostitution a girl below the age of 18. Incredibly, the sweetheart deal had not only rescued Epstein from federal detention, it had effectively branded his schoolgirl victims prostitutes. In another incredible twist, Acosta, who would later go on to become President Trump's Labor Secretary, agreed not to let the victims know of the court's decision, even though that was illegal according to federal law. Epstein was found guilty of 1 charge of soliciting an underage prostitute in 2008 and was sentenced to 18 months in the Palm Beach County Stockade instead of the state prison where sex offenders are usually incarcerated. He served just 13 months of the sentence in a private wing of the prison where his cell door was unlocked. He was allowed out on day release for up to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. He was driven to and from his office by his own private driver and was accompanied by Palm Beach police officers whose overtime pay was provided by Epstein himself. Overall, Epstein paid $128,000 to Palm Beach police for their services during this time, which may have even included turning a blind eye while he entertained minors at the small office he visited for several hours a day. All records of visitors to the office have been destroyed. How did Epstein get away with one of the most shockingly open displays of corruption in modern US legal history? The answer came straight from the mouth of Acosta himself, The state attorney told a Trump team that was interviewing him for the position of Labor Secretary that he was told to back off because Epstein belonged to intelligence and was above his pay grade. The answer is clear. Something about Epstein's intelligence work was so explosive it could bail him out of even the most serious charges. What was it? The most obvious answer is the dirt he had on some of the most important people in the US from his sexual blackmail operation. Could this have included Bill Clinton? Clinton's wife, Hillary, was in the middle of her first presidential campaign at the time, so it would have been vital to keep any scandals involving her husband covered up, no matter what the cost. And it wasn't as if Bill Clinton didn't have previous form, or that the Clintons were averse to getting their hands dirty, as will be revealed in a later chapter. Whatever the truth behind the sweetheart deal, it robbed dozens of victims of justice, whilst, to add insult to injury, effectively branding them prostitutes and securing their tormentor from future prosecution. It must have seemed like justice would never come. In any event, it would take more than a decade. After his release, remorse seemed far from Epstein's mind. In fact, he celebrated with a lavish party in his New York mansion. Prince Andrew, Woody Allen, and former Clinton advisor George Stephanopoulos were just some of the high-profile guests. Epstein did have the good sense, however, to pivot his intelligence work away from sexual blackmail with minors to a more technologically focused operation. In 2010, Epstein announced MindShift, a scientific conference that would host some of the superstars of the scientific world, including Nobel Prize-winning physicist Murray Gell-Mann, AI expert Gerald J. Sussman, and Nobel Prize-winning chemical engineer Francis Arnold, among many others. The conference was held on Epstein's private Caribbean island, Little St. James, which he had purchased in 1998. It marked the beginning of a decade of collaboration with some of the top scientists and technology entrepreneurs from the US and around the world. Many of them attended lavish dinner parties at the Manhattan Mansion, and others flew to Little St. James, or his 10,000-acre Zorro Ranch in New Mexico. They included probably the most famous scientist of modern times, Stephen Hawking, Nobel Prize winner and discoverer of the quark, Murray Gell-Mann, theoretical physicist Lawrence Krauss, and cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker, to name just a few. In terms of technologists and entrepreneurs, Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Tesla and SpaceX's founder Elon Musk were just two of the figures on his radar. The New Mexico ranch became something of a hub for Epstein's scientific enterprises. It had its own hospital, which was equipped to perform major surgery, and a mock-up Wild West-style town where visitors could stay. According to a 2019 New York Times article, Epstein intended to use the ranch to seed the human race with his own DNA by impregnating up to 20 women at a time. Jaron Lanier, one of the creators of virtual reality and one of the scientists who Epstein courted, told the Times he had the impression that Epstein's many dinner parties, which included many attractive female academics, were in fact being used to screen candidates to bear his children. Epstein also wanted to have his two most important, to himself, body parts cryogenically frozen so that he could be brought back to life in the future. These were his head and his oddly shaped penis. Victim testimonies corroborate that Epstein's penis was egg-shaped. Much of what Epstein was looking into was uncomfortably close to eugenics and should have been as disturbing to his academic guests as his criminal past. However, it just goes to show that in any field, money and influence can cover a multitude of sins. and there was plenty of money and influence coming from Epstein's direction. Epstein was involved in, or funding some of, the most prestigious research and academic bodies in the US, including the Santa Fe Institute, the Theoretical Biology Initiative at the Institute for Advanced Study, the Quantum Gravity Program at the University of Pennsylvania, and the Mind-Brain Behavior Advisory Committee at Harvard University. Harvard was one of Epstein's biggest beneficiaries, perhaps because he sought validation from it. He was often pictured wearing a Harvard sweatshirt, giving the impression he had attended the university. The prestigious university received tens of millions of dollars in funding from Epstein, as did the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, just down the road. Why was Epstein doing this? Partly, it seems, for his reputation and his vanity, as a self-styled intellectual heavyweight, but also because the titbits these scientists let slip over dinner could be crucially important to the intelligence agencies he was working for, particularly where they touched upon technology, weapons, and surveillance. In terms of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs he courted, there might be an even more direct intelligence aim: the bugging of new technologies and software for spying purposes, as will be discussed in a later chapter. By 2019, Epstein appeared to be back on top of the world. However, a few cracks in his apparently unbreakable armor had begun to appear. From 2015 onwards, he faced a number of civil lawsuits from his various victims, all of which were dismissed or settled out of court. In February 2019, a case brought by two of the Florida victims against the US government concerning the legality of the sweetheart deal was judged in their favor. The Department of Justice ruled that the US government had indeed acted illegally, particularly in concealing the non-prosecution agreement from the victims. The way was now open for further prosecutions. The inevitable came on July the 6th, 2019. Epstein was arrested at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey as he disembarked for the last time from the Lolita Express. At the same time, FBI agents stormed his Manhattan townhouse, seizing hundreds of pieces of incriminating evidence, such as pictures and videos of his victims, nude or in sex acts with other men. Epstein was charged with sex trafficking and conspiracy to traffic minors for sex. The state attorney for the Southern District of New York, Jeffrey Berman, made it clear at a press conference that the non-prosecution agreement, made in Florida, would not be binding in New York. Justice, it seemed, was finally about to catch up with the man who had for so long been untouchable. In the end, justice was visited on Epstein, but not the kind that anyone had expected.